Ekatra Podcast Conversations for the Curious Essential Knowledge, Simplified, your gateway to essential ideas that matter most. This audio summary has been prepared with the help of Ekatra AI. Welcome back, everyone. You've probably heard those exciting stories, maybe even conspiracies, about the lost books of the Bible, you know, the secret texts that got suppressed or hidden away.
The stuff of novels and documentaries, often.
Exactly. Well, today we're going to cut through some of that noise. We're doing a deep dive into Paul Foster's really essential book, The Apocryphal Gospels. It gives us the actual history. Messy, fascinating, but definitely not simple.
That's the perfect way to put it. And our goal here, our mission really, is to shift perspective. Foster wants us to move past thinking of these apocryphal texts as just, you know, forbidden secrets.
Right. Not the Da Vinci Code version.
Definitely not. Instead, we should see them as incredibly valuable historical windows. They show us just how complex and, frankly, diverse early Christian thinking really was.
And why is understanding that complexity important today? Why should we care now?
Well, because it pushes back against this overly neat picture of Christianity just appearing fully formed. It reveals this vibrant, sometimes chaotic marketplace of ideas right at the start.
So different groups wrestling with huge questions simultaneously.
Precisely.
Yeah.
You had Jewish Christians, Gnostics, proto-Orthodox groups, all interpreting Jesus, all producing texts, the ones that eventually made it into the New Testament. That's only part of the picture. These other gospels tell a crucial part of the story.
Right.
And guiding us through this is Paul Foster. Now, he's not just anyone. He's the professor of New Testament and early Christianity at the University of Edinburgh, a top scholar.
So he's coming at this as a historian, fundamentally.
Absolutely. With academic rigor.
Yeah.
Not grinding an axe, not trying to debunk or sensationalize. He brings that crucial balance.
And that academic weight is key, isn't it?
Yeah.
He's also the editor of Novum Testamentum. That's a major respected journal in the field.
It is. So he knows the canonical texts inside out, but he also has deep expertise in all this non-canonical literature. That dual perspective is what makes him such a reliable guide.
It allows him to kind of sidestep the usual traps.
Exactly. He avoids the extremes. He's not dismissing these texts out of hand as, you know, worthless heresy, but he's also not buying into the hype that they hold some kind of lost ultimate secret.
Just evidence-based history.
Evidence-based history. He's the kind of careful, clear-eyed guide you need for a topic that's often, let's face it, surrounded by a lot of fog and speculation.
Okay, so let's dig into the book's core idea. Foster's central premise is what exactly?
It's that these non-canonical gospels, the ones outside the New Testament, are absolutely indispensable if you want to understand the world of early Christianity. The first few centuries were turbulent, diverse.
And these texts were part of that turbulence.
They reflect it. They show how different communities were trying to figure things out. Huge theological questions about Jesus, about salvation. They were working it out in these writings.
And he tackles that big misconception head on, the one about the secret council.
Right away. He systematically dismantles this popular idea that, you know, some shadowy group met in a back room and just voted books in or out.
Which is what a lot of people think happened, right?
It's a persistent myth. But Foster shows, very clearly, that the formation of the canon, the list of official books, was nothing like that. It was slow, gradual, took centuries.
How did it happen then, if not by a vote?
It was more about usage and reception. Which texts were being read in churches? Which ones fit with the core beliefs already developing what they called the rule of faith? It was about building consensus over a long, long time.
Yeah.
Messy human history, not some conspiracy.
Got it. And the book itself helps us navigate this potentially confusing landscape.
Yeah, he structures it really helpfully. He groups the texts by type, basically. So you have infancy gospels about Jesus's childhood, then sayings gospels, and then accounts that expand on the passion or resurrection stories.
Okay, before we jump into those categories, maybe clarify the word apocryphal itself. It sounds kind of suspicious.
That's a great point. Originally, apocryphas just meant hidden, maybe texts kept for initiated circles. But later, yeah, it definitely took on the meaning of spurious or inauthentic, especially once the canon started solidifying.
So the meaning shifted.
It did. And Foster emphasizes that in the early centuries, that line between in and out was much blurrier than we often imagine. So to help us sort through it, he kind of puts the texts into rough categories based on their role.
Okay. What are those categories?
Well, first, you had texts that were maybe actual contenders for being included in the New Testament for a while, things like the Shepherd of Hermas. Second, texts that mainly supplemented the story, filling in details the main gospels left out.
Like Jesus' childhood.
Exactly. And third, texts that offered really different alternative ways of thinking, often what we now call Gnostic texts.
Let's start with that second group, the ones filling the gaps. Because the main Gospels are pretty quiet about Jesus' early life, aren't they?
Famously silent, between the birth stories and his public ministry starting around age 30. Basically nothing. And people were naturally curious. So the infancy Gospels jumped right into that void.
And one key example is the Protoevangelium of James.
Yes, though ironically, it's less about Jesus and more about Mary, his mother. It tells these stories of her own miraculous birth, her childhood spent in the temple.
Ah, so it's building up Mary's story.
Precisely. And crucially, it heavily emphasizes her perpetual virginity. This idea became incredibly important later on, shaping Marian devotion, art, theology.
So a non-canonical text ended up having this massive influence on mainstream Christian tradition.
It's one of the great ironies. Probably one of the most influential texts outside the New Testament canon, shaping popular piety for centuries, even though it never officially made the cut.
Wow. Okay, so that's one type of infancy gospel. But then you mentioned another one, the infancy gospel of Thomas. You said it was wild.
Oh, it's a completely different vibe. Stark contrast. This text portrays Jesus as a child who is powerful, definitely willful, and sometimes downright dangerous.
Dangerous? How so?
Well, there's the most famous or infamous story. Jesus, as a young boy, is playing, and another kid accidentally bumps into him.
Okay, an everyday childhood thing.
Right, but this Jesus, according to this text, uses his divine power to strike the other child dead on the spot.
Wait, what? He kills another child for bumping into him.
That's what the text says. Now, later in the story, he does bring the child back to life, but
yeah,
it's pretty shocking stuff.
That's deeply unsettling. How does Foster interpret something like that? It seems so counter to the image of Jesus we know.
He sees it as a really raw, maybe even primitive, attempt to grapple with Christology, with the question of Jesus's nature.
Hmm.
And the authors are thinking, okay, if Jesus was fully divine right from birth, what would that actually look like in a child?
Before he learned restraint, maybe?
Perhaps. It's like they depicted this raw divine power before it was channeled into the focused, compassionate ministry we see later. It's theology being worked out through, well, pretty shocking folklore. It highlights the problems they faced figuring this stuff out.
Okay, so infancy gospels explore Christology through narrative, sometimes strange narrative.
Yeah.
What about texts that ditch the narrative structure? You mentioned Sayings Gospels.
Right. And the big one there, the most famous non-canonical text discovered in the 20th century, is the Gospel of Thomas.
Found at Nag Hammadi in Egypt, right?
That's the one. And it's completely different from Matthew, Mark, Luke, or John. It's not a story. It's just a list, 114 sayings attributed to Jesus. Some are cryptic, some are paradoxical. No birth, no miracles, no death, no resurrection, just sayings.
That alone challenges our idea of what a gospel even is.
Absolutely. And the content, the theological feel, is often very different too. Many sayings have what scholars identify as a Gnostic flavor.
Gnostic. What does that mean in this context?
It generally involves an emphasis on salvation coming through secret knowledge gnosis, often about discovering the divine spark within yourself, finding the kingdom inside. This is quite different from the canonical gospel's focus on faith in Jesus' death and resurrection as the path to salvation.
So Thomas represents a kind of parallel stream of early Christian thought.
You could say that. A different way of understanding Jesus' message, focusing on inner wisdom rather than historical events. Its discovery really opened up our understanding of that early diversity.
Incredible. And this diversity didn't stop there. It even extended to how they told the story of Jesus' death and resurrection.
Oh, yes. There are alternative passion and resurrection accounts, too. Take the Gospel of Peter. We only have fragments, but they're fascinating.
What's unique about it?
A couple of things stand out. First, it really goes out of its way to exonerate Pontius Pilate, the Roman governor. It shifts the blame for the crucifixion much more heavily onto Herod and the Jewish authorities.
Which probably tells us something about the community writing it, maybe their relationship with Roman power.
Exactly. It reflects their specific historical or political situation. But the really spectacular part is the resurrection scene itself.
How so?
It's highly supernatural, almost theatrical.
Yeah.
You have these two giant angelic-like figures descending from heaven to the tomb, the stone rolling away by itself. And then, get this, the cross itself comes out of the tomb.
The cross comes out.
Yes. And according to the text, a voice asks from heaven if the message has been preached to those who sleep, and the cross answers, yes.
A talking cross. Seriously.
A literal talking cross. It's incredibly dramatic. And theologically, it might suggest a view called Docetism. The idea that Christ was so divine, he only seemed to suffer and die. Again, a very different take on the core event.
Wow. Okay, one more example from this category. You mentioned the Gospel of Nicodemus.
Ah, yes. This one became hugely popular later, especially in the Middle Ages. It includes Pilate's perspective, but its most famous part is the section called the Descensus ad Inferos.
The descent into hell.
Exactly. It's this incredibly vivid, dramatic story of what Jesus did between his crucifixion and resurrection. He storms the gates of Hades, confronts and defeats Satan, and frees the souls of the righteous figures from the Old Testament, Adam, Abraham, Moses, all of them.
That sounds like an epic scene.
It totally is. And that imagery, Christ breaking down the doors of hell, leading the captives out, became a standard, almost defining image in medieval Christian art and literature for centuries.
Another non-canonical text shaping popular imagination.
Absolutely. It answered a question people had. What happened to the faithful who died before Jesus? This text provided a powerful, satisfying answer, even though it wasn't in the official scriptures.
Okay, so we've toured some of these amazing, varied, sometimes bizarre texts. If we step back, what are the main lessons, the big takeaways Foster wants us to get from all this?
I think there are a few key themes. First, and maybe most important, the rich diversity of early Christianity. It just hammers home that the early church wasn't monolithic. It was this bubbling cauldron of ideas, interpretations, communities.
The apocryphal gospels are the proof.
They're the primary evidence. They show us this pluralism in action. The orthodoxy we know today had to emerge from that mix. It wasn't the only option on the table initially.
Okay, diversity first. What's second?
Second is how these texts function in filling the narrative gaps. We saw it with the infancy gospels. The canonical texts leave silences, maybe deliberately, but human nature, religious curiosity, it abhors a vacuum.
So these texts rush in to provide the details.
Exactly. They satisfy that desire for a more complete story, the backstory, the sequels, the missing scenes.
Makes sense. And the third takeaway?
Theological exploration and debate. These weren't just, you know, fan fiction. They were arenas where serious theological wrestling was happening.
Like the weird Christology in the infancy gospel of Thomas.
Yes, or the different resurrection accounts, or the Gnostic ideas in Thomas. They show communities grappling with fundamental questions. Who is Jesus? How divine? How human? How does salvation work? These texts are like snapshots of live theological debates in progress.
And maybe a final point about their value for us.
Right. Foster emphasizes their historical value beyond truth. The point isn't really to ask if the talking cross in the Gospel of Peter is true. The real value for historians and for us trying to understand the past is what these texts reveal about the people who wrote them, read them, valued them.
They're like mirrors reflecting the communities.
Exactly. Mirrors reflecting their hopes, their fears, their arguments, their social situations, their understanding of the divine. That's their enduring value.
Foster really frames this well. You mentioned some of his core statements. Let's revisit those because they really cut to the chase. First, the one challenging the conspiracy idea.
Yeah, he says something like, "The non-canonical gospels are not a collection of banned books suppressed by a shadowy conspiracy, but rather the literary remnants of the immense religious creativity and diversity that characterized the first few centuries of the Christian movement."
That just completely reframes it, doesn't it?
Yeah.
Away from secrets and suppression toward creativity and diversity.
It replaces that simplistic thriller plot with a much more complex and frankly more interesting historical reality.
Okay, and the next one, about why they wrote these things, about the imagination involved.
Right. He contrasts them with the canonical texts, where the canonical gospels are marked by a dignified silence. The apocryphal gospels are characterized by a pious and often wild imagination, seeking to answer the questions that the more restrained narratives refuse to ask.
Wild imagination.
Yeah.
I like that. It captures the feel of some of those stories, like the talking cross or the deadly child Jesus.
It does. It points to a difference in purpose, maybe even literary style. The canonical authors often aimed for a certain restraint, maybe theological precision. Some of these other authors were clearly aiming for more drama, more answers, more, well, imagination.
And the final quote, the one that tells us how we should approach them.
This one is key for anyone studying them. To ask whether the Gospel of Thomas or the Gospel of Peter is true is to ask the wrong question. The more productive question is, what does this text tell us about the community that produced it?
So shift from asking, is it true, to what does it reveal?
Exactly. Put on your historian hat, use the text as evidence about the past, about the people and their beliefs, rather than judging it against later standards of orthodoxy. It's about historical insight, not making a religious judgment on the text itself. And that perspective, that historical mindset, leads directly into the real-life applications, how we can use this understanding.
Okay, how does studying ancient apocryphal texts help us today?
Well, first, it's an amazing lesson in developing source literacy. Seriously. Yeah. The whole story of how these texts were written, transmitted, argued about, included or excluded, it forces you to think critically about sources.
Asking those historian questions.
Constantly. Who wrote this? Why? For whom? What's their agenda? What's their context? Learning to ask that about the Gospel of Peter helps you ask it about a news article or a social media post today.
Huh. Ancient history is modern media training. I like it.
It really is. Second, seeing that Christianity itself began with such a wide spectrum of belief that orthodoxy had to compete and eventually win out can foster understanding religious pluralism and tolerance.
Awesome.
It just encourages a bit of humility, doesn't it? If your own tradition started out as one voice among many, maybe it helps you engage more respectfully with different faiths or even different branches within your own faith today. It shows that diversity is often the starting point, not the exception.
That's a powerful point. Any others?
One more. It gives you a richer understanding of the New Testament itself. When you know about the Gnostic ideas floating around or the kinds of stories being told in the infancy Gospels, you can sometimes see the canonical Gospels responding to those things.
Ah, so the New Testament texts weren't written in a vacuum.
Not at all. They were part of this bigger dynamic conversation. Knowing the other side of the conversation, the texts that didn't make it in helps you appreciate the choices, the emphasis, the arguments being made by the texts that did.
That makes a lot of sense. It adds depth. So wrapping up, what was the most surprising or striking thing for you from this deep dive?
For me, it's always the sheer influence of some of these non-canonical texts on popular culture and belief, long after they were deemed non-scriptural.
Like the proto-evangelium of James defining Mary.
Exactly, or the Gospel of Nicodemus defining the harrowing of hell in art. It shows that what captures the popular imagination, what tells a compelling story, can sometimes be more powerful in shaping belief than official pronouncements. History is shaped by stories people tell and retell. And perhaps the final thought, the one to really chew on, is this. The Orthodox Christianity that emerged and became dominant wasn't the inevitable outcome. It was one successful trajectory among many vibrant competing forms of early Christianity. Its success was the result of a long, complex, very human historical process. Understanding that process is key.
A fascinating journey through hidden history.
Indeed.
See you next time with another remarkable thinker, another powerful book, and another idea that has shaped our world. This audio summary is brought to you by Acatra Foundation.